This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
I don't know if you noticed it, but people are feeling uncomfortable about where we are economically. No one seems to be feeling good about the economy, about wages, about jobs. That is especially being reflected in this year's election. In reality, we really seem to be right at this transition point, almost right on a teeter-tottery razor's edge between easing and tightening. And so we're halfway in between. Usually when you get halfway, a lot of people can't figure out what's going on. To them, it's very, very confusing, and they don't realize they're in a transition state. As a matter of fact, if you look at this whole idea of nobody feeling good about yada, 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 you can see that in the election campaign. Say, for example, Senator Bernie Sanders, a lot of people believe that he's going to fight for the little guy and we're going to try to get more jobs. He's promising jobs and stuff. But what's really telling about where we are was a story that came out in the Wall Street Journal that after 15 years and $1.5 trillion in fostering student loans to theoretically make college viable for people. Remember that Senator Sanders is promising free college. Okay. 7 million loans are in default. These are student loans. They're in default right now. And 70% of the people taking those loans dropped out of college. Now, the people who drop out of college, because you can't bankrupt out of this particular debt, they're still saddled with the debt, even though they just sort of dropped out and said, well, I didn't get my degree. I didn't get my life's career from that. Why should I feel obligated to pay this debt? And that's why you see such a tremendous push to try to forgive student debt, because it's become a huge burden right now. But it is as a sign of the place where we are.
Well, it is. You know, it's been called the new normal, whatever you want to call it. But it's obvious this economic recovery hasn't looked like anything that preceded it. And there are a lot of people who are unhappy. Wages have remained stagnant. It's taken an incredible amount of stimulus to get the unemployment rate down. And if you really think of the number of people that aren't working, the number of people that aren't participating, the number of people that are working part-time, the real unemployment rate, John, is above 10%. It's kind of like if you look at the employment numbers at 4.7%, it really isn't a good figure. It's kind of like looking at Chinese economic growth at 7%. Nobody believes that number, just as nobody believes that the real unemployment rate in this country is below 5%. And it's obviously that we operate in a different financial world today than, let's say, what preceded this prior to the financial crisis. I mean, you know, we always looked at Japan and we always said, well, that can happen here. Well, guess what? It happened here. It's been with us for going on almost 8 years now. Negative rates around the globe today are something we haven't seen. Probably the only time that you really had negative interest rates, you'd have to go back to the 70s when the dollar was really falling in the currency markets and people were trying to get out of the dollar. They were putting their money in Deutschmarks. They were trying to get their money in Switzerland. And if you had a Swiss bank account, the Swiss government actually charged you an interest rate to keep your money on deposit, just as JP Morgan and the large banks like Citigroup are charging large corporate depositors, they're charging them a negative interest rate to keep their money on deposit. So, John, if you look at this world today, the world is kind of become Japan. What was facing Japan for the last 25 years is the world that exists today. And we're a world of QE, even though the Fed has stopped its quantitative easing. You have Europe, you have Japan, you have China, and look at the results. It's interesting, but nobody is happy. They're not happy in England. This month, the Brits will vote on whether to exit the euro. They're not happy in terms of what has been the result. Nobody likes bailing out Greece. Nobody likes bailing out other countries. Just as, you know, for example, in our campaign, Bernie Sanders is saying basically student loans should be forgiven. And he's going to fight for that on the Democratic platform. And who knows what's going to be part of that. But, you know, this $1 trillion that you mentioned, which we'll talk about in the next bubble in the big picture today, who's going to pay for that? If you borrowed $1 trillion, somebody's on the hook for that. There are institutions and investors that have invested in these student loan bonds, just as there have been investors in the bonds of Puerto Rico. So there's nothing that's free out there. When you say we're going to forgive this debt or get rid of it, somebody's going to be on the hook for it. And in the end, it may just well be investors.
You know, Jim, you've been in this business for, since dirt was made. No, I'm sorry, 3 decades. if we had to look at this economic recovery versus everything you've seen in the 3 decades you've been in the business, what would you say is really standing out? What strikes you?
I mean, there are a couple things. One of the first things that struck me was the year 1999, John. In December of that year, we just sold stocks. I couldn't make sense of what was going on in the markets at that time. Companies were going public. They were valued at $5, $6 billion on the day they went public. Investors were bidding up the stock 100% in a single day. They had no sales. They had no revenues, no profits or anything. I mean, it was a crazy, crazy world. And then, of course, we had the events of 9/11, which was, you know, we always read about World War II and the attack on Pearl Harbor. But here, this was the Twin Towers in New York City. So that was sort of, you know, I'd never seen anything like that, at least in John, in your lifetime. And then what happened is Greenspan began to slash interest rates and bring the federal funds rate down to 1%. In typical cycles throughout my career, we usually operated between 3% on the Fed funds rate on the low end, 6% and 7% on the high end. If the economy heated up like it did in 1990 with oil prices rising to $40, the Fed raised interest rates or the Fed funds rate up to 6%. In fact, in 1994, during the peso crisis, the Fed under Greenspan doubled the Fed funds rate from 3% to 6% in a single year. John, can you imagine what would happen to the markets if the Fed was to double the federal fund? Well, the federal funds rate is at 0.5% now, so doubling it doesn't have the same impact. But we operated in this world for almost 3 decades at 3% to 6%. And so we always had interest rates were at a reasonable level. If you didn't like the stock market and we were going into a bear market in a recession, well, you could go hide in the bond market. I could remember getting 5 and 6% in the year 2000 for my clients in sovereign bonds because we put 40% of our portfolios. That's where we hid. It was a safe place to be in a what I considered to be the wackiest stock market I had seen in my entire career, where valuations, I mean, we were evaluating companies on clicks. In other words, the number of page views a company would get on its website was a reason for valuation. And you had analysts on Wall Street that were purporting that, hey, this is a new economy and you got to look at companies different. That was sort of crazy. But in that aftermath of the recession, the events of 9/11, Greenspan brought interest rates down to the Fed funds rate down to 1% and kept them there for 3 years until 2004 when it began to raise them in quarter point increments, taking almost over 2.5 years between Greenspan and Bernanke to get the Fed funds rate over 5%. So what is unusual to me, at least in my career and people as investors, is seeing the Fed bring interest rates down to 0.25% and keep them there, John, for almost 7 years. And if you think about last year, it took the Fed almost a whole year to raise 0.25%. And here we are in 2016. The June rate hike is out the window. As a result of the employment report, the July rate hike is probably out the window. And based on what we're seeing now with various things happening, you know, the September could be very, in other words, the Fed may have to wait to December to raise rates 0.25%. So we're certainly living in a very unusual economic environment and financial environment at the same time, because the two are going hand in hand and we're seeing things like we haven't seen before.
You know, and when you reflect on the fact that we have seen massive amounts of money printing and massive amounts of government spending, we are just not getting what used to be our bang for the buck. But remember that this is sort of where it goes as end games of currencies play out.
Well, no. In fact, there was an article this week, and here we are, ending the first half of the year, and the World Bank just came out this week and cut its global economic growth rate for the second time this year, revising it from that 3% figure. Have you noticed that? You know, whether it was the Fed predicting 3% growth rates for almost 7 years and the World Bank and IMF predicting over 3% economic growth for the world, the World Bank just revised their economic forecast for global growth down from 2.9% down to 2.4%. Now, they're doing what they always do. Okay, we're not going to hit 3% economic growth this year, but we're going to hit it next year. It'll be 3.1% next year, which I doubt. So we're just not getting it, the economic growth, and it's because there's just the age of globalization is pretty much peaked, so we're not going to see any new factories. In other words, there isn't a catalyst out there on the economic front because one of the main reasons is we have terrible, and I mean terrible, fiscal policy being pursued by governments, and the result is the stagnation that you're seeing, which, you know, if you're taking a look at this year's election, is why voters are feeling so angry as they are. But as astonishing as that has been, there's something that's even bigger, John, and that's what is going on with interest rates.
Well, maybe we should transition into that, Jim, because we've discussed these interest rates before, and we're establishing another first here worldwide. We talk about negative interest rates. Is that really the new element that we're dealing with? You know, it used to be you bought government bonds and they would pay you. It seems to be reversing now. Buy our bonds and you pay us even more.
Yeah, you're paying the government. I mean, we really hit a couple milestones this week. And for our listeners, I mean, if you're not aware of this, if you're not following events overseas, a 10-year German Bund got down to a yield of 0.49. In other words, if you were to lend money to the German government for 10 years, you would get paid 0.05%. I mean, that is absolutely crazy. Now, and I'm going to get a little technical here for those of you who aren't familiar with Wall Street terms. We refer to interest rates on Wall Street in terms of basis points. 1% is equal to 100 basis points. So, in other words, a 10-year German Bund today yields less than 5 basis points. And it gets crazy if we look at, for example, British gilts. British gilts got down to 1.26%. Now, let me spend a few moments here and explain the significance of that. The Bank of England was founded in 1694 as a means of financing King William III's war with France. Now, at various times in that history of over 300 years, the British government bond yields got down to 3%. For example, they got down to 3% in the 18th century during the Napoleonic Wars. They got down to 3% in the Austrian Succession Wars of 1751 under George II. But basically, they've been over 3%. They got down to 3% during the South Sea Bubble. They got down to 2% following World War II. In 1946, now let's brace yourself, folks, and then we had that crazy period in the 70s when U.S. Treasuries got up to 15.5, and British gilts were yielding 16%. So, in other words, this week, with British gilt yields getting down to 1.26%, John, that is the lowest interest rate in the history since the founding of the Bank of England, which was founded in 1694. So, you know, we've made some comments here. We are dealing with the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. And it gets even worse. 50-year. We were talking about 10-year. Now, if you go out, Britain has issued 50-year bonds, and the interest rate on a 50-year bond, I have no clue. First of all, John, you and I won't be alive 15 years from now. But 50 years from now, the yield on a British gilt is less than 2%. Japan is issuing 40-year bonds with the yield that is less than 0.4%. And that is just going to show you how unusual we are right now with governments printing money and this deflationary force that's working its way through the economy in the financial markets. I mean, John, you know, you tell the story that your dad was trying to leave your mom in good shape. He bought treasuries and T-bills. So upon his passing, your mother had secured securities. But look what you're getting in a bank today. Look what you can borrow today. The fact that we are looking at the lowest interest rates in England since the founding of the first central bank in the world in 1694 just goes to show you the kind of world that we're living in today.
Yeah, and Jim, despite what they're doing, you know, we talked about all the mechanisms they've tried to do to get things going. They can't get economic growth out of it. The IMF just lowered growth rates. We're down to 2.4, so you can pitch out the old 3% projection. And what people don't realize is you listen to what's going on in the debate, listen to what the people are saying about what's being said in the debate. And what they don't realize is that all of this, the policies of creating credit, taxes, and regulation, are due to government or central bank policy. And yet, even though that's been the cause of the mess that we're finding ourselves in a position worldwide, the public is clueless as to why we're in this mess. And so that makes them susceptible to doing the wrong thing or asking the wrong leaders to get them out of the mess.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because basically, if you're listening to this year's election, we've got possible trade wars. If you're looking at what Trump's talking about China, which is fallacious in every way because China has pegged its currency to the dollar. And also, you have Bernie Sanders that's basically saying what we need is more taxes and more regulation. We'll just confiscate the stuff and give you a whole bunch of free stuff when the government is on the verge of going broke. I mean, we're going to have close to $20 trillion. We will have $20 trillion of debt when Obama leaves office. George Bush doubled the national debt from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. And Obama, when he leaves office after 8 years, will have doubled the national debt from $10 to $20 trillion. And yet, what the solution being proposed is, gosh, government has done a great job. What we need is more government. And you can see it. It's being reflected in how this campaign is being run and the issues that are being discussed. But we've got some problems coming up here, and that's what's going to put the central banks in the world, especially the Fed, in a predicament in terms of what to do in the second half of the year.
So what is the problem then? I mean, is it inability to raise rates, say, for example, when we look at the Fed? Or is it that maybe politicians aren't cooperating in this whole thing? But nevertheless, markets seem to like what's going on. I mean, you can see that.
Well, the markets like it because basically the Fed has pulled us back from the precipice and saying, oh, you know, after that labor report, we're a little bit concerned. So all of a sudden, the bets for a July rate hike have come off the table. The real problem you have right now is something John Kosar and I had talked about in the first hour is we've got inflation rising. It's not just energy. I mean, the price of energy is doubled since February. We've gone from $26, we're over $50. The price of gold is going up. We've got gold approaching $1,300. But as John talked about, it's not just gold, it's ag prices are rising, base metals are rising. So raw materials are starting to rise, oil is starting to rise. And so, John, we have inflationary problems that we're going to be facing with whether you're looking at core CPI or regular CPI in the second half of the year is what the markets are telling us is inflation is on the rise again.
Well, but we come back to that question that everybody's been pondering for a long time. Why haven't we seen high inflation? So are we looking at high inflation or hyperinflation? And how are the markets perceiving all of this?
Well, I mean, the markets are perceiving this, that inflation is going to be on the rise. Now, are we looking at hyperinflation? No. But we are looking at, indeed, higher rates of inflation, whether we get up to 3 or 4% or even 5% as we did back in 2007. I don't think we're going to get that high. But nonetheless, we are going to be above the Fed's inflation. One of the objectives the Fed has had is they've been targeting this for 7 years. We haven't hit it yet, is they're targeting a 2% inflation rate. But now we do have rising inflation. We're seeing it in wages. And the Fed does not like to see wage rates rise where labor rates are going up because they consider that inflationary. But it's also having an impact on corporations. We're seeing the lowest productivity rates for corporations and for companies in this country in a long time. So what happens is higher productivity allows workers to produce more goods. It keeps a lid on inflation. It benefits the corporation. But now corporations, from 2014 to 2016, one of the big things weighing on corporate profits was a rising dollar. Now, with the Fed backing off now, we've seen the dollar weaken. But now corporations are facing a squeeze on their profit margins, and it's coming from another sector. Lower productivity, rising wages, and sluggish demand are now weighing in on corporate profits. And it's going to be interesting because next month, what we're going to be talking about is profits for the second quarter and what companies are saying on profits in the third quarter or the balance of the year. Because usually analysts start out with optimistic projections at the beginning of the year. The first quarter, none of the companies hit their projections. They lowered their predictions in terms of corporate profits. They said, oh, we'll make it up in the second quarter. Well, the second quarter isn't looking that great either. So companies are, you know, analysts will start probably here in the next couple of weeks. You're going to see companies come out and, you know, lower their projections because corporations are pretty much are going to know whether they're going to hit their numbers for the second quarter. So companies will be coming out with warnings. What will that'll cause analysts to lower their predictions for second quarter profits. And then, of course, companies will beat those profits. But the trend is what is more important. And the impact on corporate profits right now is lower productivity, rising wages, and sluggish demand, John, which are going to weigh on corporate profits.
Yeah, but Jim, the stock market's going up.
Well, it's going up because a lot of what's driving the market today is policy. And nobody wants to see the Fed raising interest rates. They like low interest rates. If you're in the markets, you can leverage that. I mean, and this is what is keeping the market up. I mean, if you're looking at the lowest interest rate on 10-year British bonds, some of the lowest rates on 10-year treasuries, I mean, 0.05% on a 10-year German bond. John, where's the money going to go? I mean, at least if I go into stocks, I can get a 3-4, in some cases, 5% dividend. And so that's what's keeping the stock market positive or floating is these historic low rates. We are, in terms of market rates, looking at the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. And so that is one thing that is keeping this financial market up.
Yeah. But Jim, you know, as we mentioned earlier on, the IMF has lowered its economic growth rate. You always talk about the LEIs, leading economic indicators. What are you seeing in them?
Well, I mean, we feel, and we've stated this, that economic growth in the U.S. peaked last year. Profits for corporations peaked in the summer of 2014. Economic growth peaked in this country in the summer of 2015. So the LEIs have peaked, John. So, I mean, there's still enough positive economic momentum in the economy. The economy probably picked up a little bit in the second quarter versus the first quarter. But we've seen the peak in economic activity in this U.S. economic recovery that began in the summer of 2009. So the LEIs have peaked, but now we are seeing some of the consequences of all this loose money, and that is inflation was starting to rise. Because remember when the Fed cut out its QE, one of the reasons the Fed never achieved its inflation targets and we had a disinflationary force was the price of oil, which peaked a little over $100 a barrel, and it began to fall in the fourth quarter of 2014. So for almost a year and a half, we saw falling energy prices. That brought down inflation rates. And so that was a thing that kept a lid on interest rates. And it made it more difficult for the Fed to start raising interest rates because, number one, we had weak economic growth. And number two, we weren't seeing inflation. So a lot of people are saying, why are you talking about raising interest rates when we have no inflation? Commodity prices were collapsing. We don't have strong economic growth. Corporate profits are weak. Why in the heck are you guys talking about raising interest rates? Well, now, John, that the LEIs have peaked, we've got a weakening economy. We're seeing this reflected in the LEIs. We're seeing it reflected globally in economic growth rates. We're seeing it reflected in poor corporate profits. But now, and we're also seeing it reflected in a weakening labor market, which is your sort of clue in terms of what's going to happen to the economy going forward. But unfortunately, now that oil prices are starting to rise. Now, you don't think about it when we were talking about $100 oil for so many years, for almost a decade, and all of a sudden we got down to $26 oil in February. But folks, we're over $50 a barrel, and we're more likely to stay in that $50 to $60 range. So all of that is being reflected. You've seen it as a consumer in terms of what you're paying for gasoline at the pump. And what is that reflected? You're going to see it in transportation costs. It's going to cost more to get ship goods and get them to the store or get them to the factory. It's going to cost more to produce things. So the Fed is really in a quandary here. And that's why we are in the situation that we're in. And it was interesting because there was an article in the Wall Street Journal talking why low interest rates aren't working, blame dividends. Companies have not made and they do not have the sales to justify making corporate investments and building new plant and equipment. So what have they done? They've resorted to financial engineering. They've been issuing debt, buying back stock, raising dividends because the economic opportunities out there, and we're going to do a special show on the end of growth because that's the world that we're going to be living in the next couple of decades. And that's why when you do get a company that is growing rapidly, like a Facebook, you see, or let's say Netflix or let's say Tesla, you see the market pay these tremendous premiums for these companies, whether it's Amazon, whether it's Tesla, whether it's Netflix, Google, all of these companies, there are premiums because it's very hard to see companies that are growing their top line anymore, much less the bottom line. And that's the quandary that the Fed finds itself in.
You know, back at the beginning of this segment, when I referred to the fact that we were sitting on this razor's edge, precariousness, so to speak, all right, still, what does that mean for investors? Because that's what you're trying to do, theoretically. And what do investors do in this type of an environment?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Fed policy loop, there's either two directions the Fed's going in. Either they're leaning towards tightening or they're leaning towards easing. Now, they've been leaning towards tightening since the summer of 2014. In May of that year, when Bernanke first announced that they were going to end quantitative easing, known as the taper, and they were going to gradually taper down. So that was a policy response that was aiming towards tightening. And certainly in the fourth quarter of last year, we saw that in the blowout of credit spreads between sovereign debt and corporate debt, and especially on junk bond yields, which got up to 8.5%. So when the Fed leans towards tightening, what happens? The dollar appreciates, something that we saw since the summer of 2014. Credit spreads widen, which is what we saw in the fourth quarter of last year. The VIX rises because now you have volatility and uncertainty injected into the market. And then you also see stock market correct, which we saw in August and September of last year. And we saw that this year in January and February, and once again in May. And what happens is the yield curve flattens. Well, what happens and what has been happening in this economic recovery, and we've seen this numerous times. How many times have you seen the Fed? I can remember when they first announced QE in the summer of 2010, when QE just ended, the Fed was talking about its exit plan. And of course, we got QE 1, 2, 3, and 4 that followed. Now, when the Fed backs off, as it has done, especially since that labor report last Friday and what the Fed did in February after what happened to the marketplace, what happens? The dollar depreciates. Credit spreads between sovereign and corporate debt begins to narrow. The VIX falls. Volatility leaves the market. The stock market begins to rise and the yield curve steepens, which is exactly what you've seen here in the last week or so. So we're right on that razor's edge, John, on the borderline between a hawkish Fed and a dovish Fed. And what happens is we get these economic reports, and what the Fed is really going to face, they're facing two things right now. They're facing a slowing economy, both here and abroad. They are facing a labor market which is we're heading more towards higher unemployment than we are lower unemployment. And as I mentioned earlier, the true unemployment rate is probably closer to 10% than it is 5%. And that's why you're seeing what you're seeing on the news today in this presidential election. So they're right there. But unlike the previous couple of years, now, John, we had 2 years of falling commodity prices. Now the Fed is facing rising commodity prices, especially in the ag sector and especially in the energy sector. And that's going to start to impact the CPI. So it's going to be more difficult for the Fed to be somewhat dovish as we see the economy weaken when you have rising prices. And that's going to put the Fed on the sort of on that teeter-totter. They're going to put them right on the, if they lean a little bit to the left, they could cause a problem, because if they do start tightening, when unemployment is due to start rising, when the economy is looking like it's heading into recession, what are they going to have to fight when they get into the next recession and bear market? Because they've only been able to raise interest rates a quarter of a point. So the dilemma that we're facing, and we've never been in this situation, John, since World War II, and not in my entire lifetime, nor in my investment career, when you have interest rates at the lowest level in recorded human history, and now we have some rising inflation, and at the same time, a slowing economy. I'll tell you, this is one time I would not want to be a central banker.
You know, we see gold prices rising right now. Other things are changing. What is going to be the ultimate outcome of the direction we're headed?
I think eventually, you know, they will try to raise interest rates. And the way it's looking right now, unless there's a miracle, it's probably they're probably going to wait to December. I just don't see them raising in July, given what's happening with the LAIs and what's happening with the labor, with the job market. I don't see them raising in September right before a presidential election. Remember when things were looking pretty bad, Janet Yellen got called to the White House and in a meeting with the president. He's probably saying, what the heck are you thinking, Janet? You know, you're a Democrat. We're in an election, and nobody likes a weak economy or a rising unemployment rate when you're heading into a presidential election. I mean, the party in office, when the economy is weak or the stock market is falling, is the party that loses the election. So if anything, John, I see them more waiting towards the end of the year. Now, won't that be something? It takes a whole year for the Fed to raise interest rates a quarter of a point. And I just don't think the economy is strong enough right now that it can withstand higher rates, especially when the markets come in and we have a blowout of credit spreads as we did last fall, anticipating the Fed was going to raise rates, which they did in December.
And for the investors, investment implications?
You know, John, we are sticking with our defensive theme. We like gold. We like high dividend paying stocks in very safe sectors of the economy like staples, utilities. We also like energy. And it's interesting because there was an article this week in the Wall Street Journal, a bearish George Soros is trading again. This is a guy that, you know, he's worth $30 billion and he's making some bearish bets and he's buying gold. He's buying gold stocks and he's buying investing gold because I'm sure he sees the macroeconomic conditions that we're talking here. So in this kind of environment, we like short-term corporate bonds, 1 and 2 years out. It's a safe place to be. We like high dividend paying stocks and in staples, utilities. We like that area. As John Kosar talked about, these are the least invested areas within the various sectors within the S&P. We also like gold here. We're living in unusual times, and you've got to be more cautious in this kind of environment because we are on that razor's edge. There's so much leeway here for a major policy mistake. And remember, one of the themes that we talked about is when the economy is growing and you've got economic growth, that provides a shock absorber to a major shock to the economy, whether it's events like we saw in 2011 with the Arab Spring, Fukushima, the debt ceiling debate, and also the pig crisis in Europe. When your economy is growing, it's a shock absorber for these kind of events. However, now with the economy weakening and economic growth rates below 1%, that shock absorber sort of thins out. So there's a lot of room here, a lot of leeway for policy mistakes. And that's why I think you got to play this cautiously, unless you're a very astute trader and you can get in and out of the market and you're monitoring them constantly. For the average person right now, I don't think this is the kind of market you want to get aggressive in. And that's been one of the themes that we've had from all the technicians that we've had on the show. So once again, stay cautious.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is Dr. Robert Eisenbeis. He's the Vice Chairman and Chief Monetary Economist at Cumberland Advisors, and he was formerly the Executive Vice President and Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Bob, you recently wrote a piece that was very fascinating titled A Hard Sell, and one of the really interesting nuggets that jumped out at me was the statistical variation that we see on the jobs numbers that come out each month that are highly, highly watched by the investment community and financial news media. But you pointed out that we see quite a large range of that number, and it's really hard to rely on from data point to data point. Would you mind telling our listeners just a little bit about how much variation there is in that number that we see?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The Bureau of Labor Statistics does a monthly survey, as everybody knows, and the focus is really on what everyone calls the headline number that they say is their estimate of what the job growth is. But what everybody forgets is that's a number that's derived based on an estimate. There's sampling error associated with it. And right now, that sampling error is on the order of 115,000, which means if they report 115,000, it might be zero. There's a 95% chance that the true number would lie between 115,000 and zero. So when you get a number like 38,000, which we had this past month, it could be as high as 150-some thousand, or it could actually be negative. And so there's an awful lot of people making decisions on the basis of a number that really has a high degree of variation associated with it.
Over the course of the years which we have been doing this program, various bubbles have been the subject of conversation. There was the tech bubble in the 1990s and the bursting of same in 2000, which, Jim, if you remember, the cause for the downturn that happened after that was offloaded onto 911, which happened a year later. But that really wasn't correct. It was simply an excuse at that time. Then in the first decade of the new century, the real estate bubble, and we saw that one coming. I remember you were predicting that as early as 2004, leading up to the financial crisis of 2007. Since that time, governments have spent trillions of dollars. Central banks have dumped trillions of dollars into their monetary systems through some form of a monetary mechanism. One would think there is a bubble forming somewhere. It's like underneath Yellowstone Park, there is this giant magma chamber forming, you know, and getting ready to erupt. You've got to have a bubble somewhere, because if that weren't true, if printing money and spending yourself into oblivion were the way to get yourself economically back on your feet, then Zimbabwe and Venezuela would be sterling examples of that type of a theory. But that is not the case. So where is the bubble?
Well, you know, there are bubbles forming out there, but they're not where you think. And one bubble that's forming is in the bond market. In the last segment, we talked about German bonds down to 5 basis points, and then the gilts down to 1.25, which is the lowest interest rate in British history since the central bank was formed. And the same thing on 50-year bonds. You've got yields of 2% less on a 50-year German bond and less than 40 basis points or 0.4% on a 40-year Japanese bond. So there's a bubble forming in the sovereign bond market because yields are being artificially suppressed with all this quantitative easing that is taking place with government. But John, there's another bubble that is formed and is unraveling. It's part of this year's election campaign, and that is in student loans. Now, the government, over 15 years, the U.S. government has made a $1 trillion investment to improve the nation's workforce productivity in the economy. And the way they were doing that is saying, hey, if we can get people a college education, they get a college education, they're better educated, that helps with productivity, they're better workers, that's going to help the economy. And so there was a huge bet made on student loans. The unfortunate thing is, just like the huge bet that was made on housing with various programs to subsidize and get people into homes they couldn't afford, now those student loans are turning toxic. And we're seeing this. The government literally has spent tens of millions of dollars on tuition enrollment in U.S. college and, you know, basically trying to promote education. So the spending on college loans to promote that from 2002 to 2012 was up 24%. And they were doing this with grants, low interest loans, loan guarantees, and student outstanding debt has basically quadrupled since 2000 to $1.2 trillion. And a lot of people saying, well, if it wasn't for that, a lot of people couldn't attend college. But the very reason is people don't understand how credit works in the economy and how inflation is created. And the example of inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. And this has been reflected in a college education. You've had a lot of money, in this case, $1.2 trillion thrown at the education system. And the result has been, with all that credit coming in, it has driven the cost of education. Where today, depending on what school you go, a private education is going to cost you anywhere from $200,000 to $280,000 for a private education. The problem, John, is a lot of this money that went into education never paid off. Many of those students never learned new skills because they dropped out. And that's one of the biggest things that they found in this study, is the vast majority of student loans went to students who never completed their education.
Well, this is strange. I mean, I know my youngest is about to get his PhD, so I'll brag on that one for a second. But we'll probably get him out of college for right around $10,000 of debt. That's a wet finger. I don't have the figures right in front of me right now, but I think that's it. And when you and I went to college, Jim, now what I was doing is I was working at a classical music radio station. I did the evening concert, and you know, you put on 20 minutes of Mozart, and during that time you could read and study. And so I went to college in the morning, and I went to the radio station in the afternoon. I worked full time, and I was in school full time, and I got out of college with close to zero debt. So the fact that people are running up abominable amounts of money is strange to me, I guess.
You and I are the same age, and we come from similar circumstances. I mean, I came from a family of 10 kids. There was no way that my parents could afford to send me to college. And what I did is I had my own business. I had a parking concession, valet parking cars at a restaurant. And the restaurant had this huge portico. And I talked the maitre d' in putting in bright lights, because I pointed out with the steps up to the restaurant, there was a possibility of a lawsuit if somebody tripped. But anyway, the advantage to me is I had this nice little booth and chair, and I sat underneath this light. And so after I got the dinner rush, I could sit there and I could study each night. And like you, John, I worked Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and I went to school on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 9 o'clock in the morning until my last class was out at 9:30. So I worked 3 days a week. And then I went to school 2 days a week. And like you, I was very fortunate, and I've always advocated this on our lifetime income program, but a 2+2 program. I went 2 years to junior college. John, I don't know if you did the same, but my tuition full time for 15 hours a semester was $45. In fact, my books cost more than my tuition. So my two-year AA degree that I got at Phoenix College, my tuition was $180 for a two-year degree. And then when I went on to Arizona State before I went on to graduate school, is my Arizona State tuition was $300 a semester. So, you know, my 2 years at Arizona State, not counting books, was $1,200. So I was fortunate enough, I was earning enough to pay my student loans and as well as pay my room and board through work. And then, of course, when I went on to graduate school, I had a scholarship. So, you know, I at least got a scholarship, so I didn't have to pay for graduate school. So when I got into the workforce and got married, you know, Mary and I began our marriage with no debt. So I was very fortunate, but that's not the case today. And unfortunately, according to Treasury Secretary Sarah Bloom, 7 million student loan borrowers are now in default, and millions of others appear on the same path. Now, here's the thing that I thought was interesting. According to the Treasury report, they tracked the earnings of 1.4 million students who left a for-profit college in 2 years through September 2008. 70% of them, John, dropped out. They never completed their program. The unfortunate thing is the debt they took on to take on that college that they never completed still remains. And so I forget what the figures are now. The average student right now, when he leaves college with $30,000 to $40,000 with debt. The average married couple brings $70,000 to $100,000 into their marriage of student loans. And that's assuming they went to public schools, not private schools. If it's private schools, you could have several hundred thousand dollars worth of debt, as many doctors do when they enter medical school. They leave medical school with, you know, several hundred thousands of dollars of debt. So there is a big debt bubble that's forming out there, and it's called the student loan market. And it's one of the reasons, John, if we talk about this year's political campaign, of the popularity of Bernie Sanders, because he's saying basically, hey, college should be free. Listen, folks, anytime you throw a lot of credit at something, I don't care if it's housing or it's education, you're going to see inflation. And the highest inflation rates next to healthcare that we've seen in this country has been education, where the inflation rate has been between 6 and 8%. So the highest two areas are those areas that are subsidized by government, which has been education and healthcare. And if you think free college, there's such a thing as free, we don't have the money for it.
So people who can't get jobs go back to school, but a lot of times we're discovering the education they are getting or taking is not being completed, or it's the wrong kind. The marketplace is radically changing as to the skills that are being required out there. And we have another conflict here.
Well, there are a number of studies. Not only are they not completing their degrees, even those that do get degrees are getting the wrong kind of degrees, because they're not getting the type of education that would equip them for today's technologically advanced economy. And right now, according to the government, a fifth, 20% of all student debt outstanding is at least 90 days delinquent. And so it's not just that they can't pay it, they're not completing their programs. And John, you know, you've got $1 trillion of debt. Somebody is going to have to pay that, because a lot of those student loans got issued in bonds, Sallie Mae bonds. So there are institutions, pension funds that own that debt, just like there are a lot of investors that bought the municipal bonds of Puerto Rico. So when Puerto Rico can't make a debt payment, if Sallie Mae can't make a debt payment because students are defaulting on their loans, who's going to suffer? It's going to be the investors that are holding. And that's typically what has happened to bond investors. And you really got to be careful here. But anything the government subsidizes and throws a lot of money at, there are two things that are happening. Number one, you're going to see inflation cost. And you can just take a look at that in terms of education and healthcare. Number two, in addition to inflation, it's poorly run. There's too much money thrown at it. And certainly today, you can say a lot of people are walking out of a college degree with a degree that does not prepare them for the real world to get a job. And look at the nonsense of some of the stuff that's going on at our universities today. And that's why there's a movement for not only, let's say, online education, work programs with education, but also, John, what we call trade schools. A lot of corporations, especially a lot of manufacturing firms, are wanting to hire qualified workers. But today's factory is much different than the factory that existed prior to World War II. And because today's high factory is run by robotics, so you have to have math skills, you have to have computer programming skills, you have to be able to read and write skills. And look how many students, John, that are not being taught the things that they need, the skill set they need when they get out in the workforce. And it's tragic because they're spending a fortune to get educated, but they're not getting much in return for that education.
Not only that, Jim, but the issue of politically correct speech. Free speech is under attack on college campuses. And you would think that colleges, remember this back in the 60s, where all the radicals who were protesting insisted on the right to freedom of speech. Well, those same radicals or their descendants are now saying, oh no, we have to control speech. We shouldn't have hate speech. Everybody has to have a safe zone, blah, 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 blah. Not to mention a lot of the courses that are being offered are just downright idiotic. So the whole system, you're paying a huge amount of money, more than we ever used to pay for it, and yet the system itself has gone off the rails as far as what's reality and related to reality-based employment or careers or lifetime in many cases.
Yeah, and that was interesting because there was a nonpartisan report by the Third Way Foundation, and they were saying, on average, nearly 4 in 10 undergraduates at those schools who took on student debt earned no more than $25,000 a year, the same as a typical high school student. And that was one of the things that was always recommended, why you wanted to go to college, because it was proven for so long that if you went to college and graduated, you were going to earn a lot more money over your lifetime than, let's say, somebody that maybe got no further than a high school education. But today, you got people in the trades that are making as much as college graduates. So there's so many programs out there that are just basically nonsense. In other words, they're worthless degrees. You got a degree, but that degree can't help you get a decent job that'll enable you to pay back those loans. And that's why I think, John, you're going to see a major change here. In the next decade, you're going to see trade schools, much like the guilds that we had in the 14th century. You're going to see, instead of, you know, you get out of high school and mom and dad sending you away to a college, room and board, parents are simply not going to be able to afford it, and junior won't be able to afford it when you take a look at the piles of debt that would have to be taken on to live, let's say, away from home on campus at a dorm. Only the very privileged are going to be able to do that. But also, you're going to get schools that are going to come out and they're going to be more technical in nature, much like the technical guilds that we had in the 13th and 14th century, right around the period of the Renaissance. And corporations are helping fostering this. They're working with junior colleges and saying, look, we need a program that enables somebody to have this kind of skill set, because this kind of skill set we need to work in our factory. But John, if we take a look at what we've seen right now, there is a bubble out there, and that bubble is being formed in the student loan market. A lot of these loans are going to get defaulted on. Investors are going to end up holding the bag. And mark my words, I don't care if it's Trump or Clinton, this is going to be an issue that the next president of the United States is going to have to face, because there is a bubble in loans, and simply throwing more money at it, which is the typical government solution, does not fix it. We have spent trillions of dollars on this, and look at the problem that we have now. Now it's starting to come apart at the seams. Students are defaulting. They're dropping out. There's something wrong here, and there's a bubble in the education.
So if we had to pick a spot where we would say the bubble is forming, it's got to be a bubble here somewhere. Somebody's got to go to jail. Remember that line from National Treasure? Okay. Got to be a bubble somewhere here.
There's got to be a bubble, and somebody's got to pay for it. Somebody's got to go to jail.
All right. Probably what? The government bond market and the student loan market. Those are the two areas where this thing is forming.
And I think eventually, John, you're going to see an asset bubble. I mean, eventually, the stock market is being kept afloat today, not on fundamentals. The stock market is being kept afloat today because interest rates are at the lowest they've been in recorded human history. I mean, do you really want to loan the Bank of England money at less than 2% for 50 years? Do you want to loan the German government money for 0.05%? Or for that matter, Japan, loan money to the government of Japan for 40 years for less than 0.4%. So we're going to see an asset bubble. And eventually it's going to be in the stock market. It's already in the bond market. It's being reflected in these historical low yields. So we have asset bubbles forming everywhere. And we know in the end, bubbles don't last forever. Whatever can inflate eventually deflates. And we are going to see another bear market. We're going to see another recession. And hopefully, this time around, we will have more appropriate government policy coming out. Because the problem, John, is fiscal policy. I don't care if it's the U.S. government under Obama trying to emulate what's going on in Europe or the moribund economies of Europe that are strangled, where you've got unemployment rates of 10-25% over in Europe. And their economies, they haven't grown at 1% for almost a decade. So hopefully we'll have smarter fiscal policy, or otherwise we're going to go back to what we did in the 1930s, engaged in trade wars. And eventually, you know, if I was to quote Frederick Bastiat, when goods don't cross borders, armies do. And hopefully we don't get to that point. But anyway, those are where the bubbles are right now, which is another reason why we are recommending owning gold and why investors should remain cautious.
Actually, I've modified that statement somewhat, Jim. I say where goods and services don't cross borders, armies and missiles do. That's the modern version of that. Coming up next week, let's see, when are we going to hear the Fed announcement? Is it raise or not raise?
Next week, we got the Fed meeting coming in. Nobody expects rates to rise, but they will be looking at clues if they moderate that, because we have another Fed meeting coming in July. And remember, until last Friday's unemployment report, the bets were about a 50% or more that they were going to go in July. Now those bets have dropped down in half. So we'll be looking for clues. So two events coming up in the next couple of weeks. We got the FOMC meeting next week, and look for clues for corporate earnings warnings, because Q1 is about ready to end here in the next 2 weeks. And in July, we'll be talking about, well, same things we're talking about June. But in July, we'll be talking about the FOMC meeting in July. Will they or will they not? And then we'll also be talking about corporate earnings. All that coming up in the weeks ahead. We'll be here to talk about it. Hope you'll be joining us as well. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.